Hello there. Today is Tuesday, April 3rd. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, fears of a trade war after China retaliates against the new U.S. trade tariffs.
It is going to take a lot of care to make sure this does not spin out of control.
Trump's battle over a border wall heats up. Protests in California over the killing of an unarmed black man. Also ahead, South Africa loses an icon in the fight against apartheid.
We are 30 million. The poor in Mali, Mata Adjal, Muhammad,
the regime can go to hell.
It's all on today's International Edition. China has increased tariffs by up to 25% on 128 U.S. products, escalating a dispute between the world's biggest economies. China's actions are in response to U.S. duties on imports of aluminum and steel. The news on Monday sent U.S. stocks plunging. Joining us to talk about it and what it all means is Scott Kennedy, Deputy Director of the Freeman Chair of China Studies and Director of the Project on Chinese Business and Political Economy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Thank you for being with us. So are we on the verge of a trade war?
Well, it does look like the potential start of a trade war, that's right. But we don't know that yet. China has taken in some ways, a very measured step in retaliating on what the United States has done. And I say in some ways a very measured step because the United States put steel and aluminum tariffs on about $3 billion worth of Chinese exports to the United States. China just levied tariffs on about $3 billion worth of U.S. exports to China. And on the one hand, it's the same, $3 billion and $3 billion. On the other hand, the U.S. exports less to China than going the other way. So China put their tariffs on a higher proportion of U.S. exports to China. But usually in international trade, it's done on the dollar value when you do this kind of retaliation.
The White House is criticizing China for the tariffs after it imposed these retaliatory tariffs against the U.S.
I think the White House view is that the United States trade measures were justified and legal, certainly legal under U.S. law. And I think the White House would probably make an argument that they were justified and legal under international trade agreements. There is a national security carve-out within the WTO. If the U.S. trade measures were perfectly legal within its international agreements, then any kind of retaliation by China would not be justified. Mm-hmm. I think it's China's view that the United States move was not within its legal agreements, and that therefore China is in fact justified in retaliating. China was very careful in their language, and what they said was that their move was a discontinuation of concessions, and that's WTO language. So they're not retaliating formally. They're discontinuing concessions, trade concessions. And what they said is that the U.S. move, which the U.S. says is on the grounds of national security, is not actually national security. It actually is what would be known, in their opinion, what would be known in international trade law as a safeguard measure. And if it's a safeguard measure, then they say they're justified in retaliating. The only way that can really be settled is through a WTO tribunal. Those take a very long time. The United States has been unhappy with the results in some cases, although has fared well in other cases. And how this will really be settled probably is through bilateral negotiations. So that's kind of a long way of saying we're not really at a trade war, but we're kind of testing the bounds. The United States, if it stops now, chances are China will stop now, and they'll negotiate. It will be maybe Secretary Ross from Commerce will be negotiating with China's top point man on the economy, Liu He, and so this might be resolved.
The leaders of either of these nations don't seem like they would be the type to back down just for the sake of backing down.
That's correct. I do not think that China will remove the measures that it instituted unless the United States takes some steps. Both the leaders of both countries will have to declare a victory in some way, or at least a mutually beneficial pause. Because even though China is an authoritarian government, has become more authoritarian, they still have public opinion. So outside of government and inside of government, there will be different factions. So So there is a kind of a public presentation.
Is the president accurate when he says that, you know, the U.S. has been treated very unfairly for a very long time, saying when a country is losing many billions of dollars on trade with virtually every country it does business with, trade wars are good and easy to win?
Trade wars on their own are not good, but they're always linked to what policy are you trying to achieve?
Mm-hmm.
Is it the least cost way to achieve it? And is there a better way to achieve that policy? This can get worse. The United States will announce the tariffs it plans to institute on China,
mm-hmm.
on the Section 301 measure sometime, I think, this week or next week. And that's planning to institute increased tariffs on $50 or $60 billion worth of goods. China will retaliate. There will be a period, there will be a hearing period, and then eventually we'll institute them. We're also going to increase investment barriers against China. So it can get worse. The second thing is, are trade wars good? Well, trade wars are costly, and they raise taxes on consumers and on businesses. They tend to alienate friends and allies. And in general, unless you have a really well-defined goal that raising tariffs can meet, there have to usually be better ways better ways to achieve these policy goals. What will happen now? China's retaliatory tariffs will hurt some groups of people in the United States. They will hurt ginseng farmers in Wisconsin. They will hurt a few other groups that are being targeted. A much larger trade war has the potential to hurt a lot of employees and help a few others. I and most people would say is you don't want to actively seek a trade war. It's a last resort. That said, you know, interpreting what the president means by all this, we don't know if it's a negotiating ploy. We don't know if this is his way of putting pressure. We don't know what his kind of bottom line is in these things. But I think it is going to take a lot of care to make sure this does not spin out of control.
All right. Scott Kennedy, director of the Freeman Chair in China Studies at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. Saudi Crown Prince says Israelis have a right to their own land. UN Security Council delegation may visit Myanmar and Bangladesh. New York taxi drivers are despairing as ride-sharing apps cut into their business. And the U.S. Justice Department challenges another California law. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. For the second day in a row on Monday, President Donald Trump railed against illegal immigration in the U.S. at its southern border with Mexico, contending that America is being stolen by migrants. Trump in the past has said he would show great heart for the plight of the young immigrants protected by deportation under the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA program, and said he'd keep the program in place in exchange for full funding of a wall he once built along the U.S.-Mexican border to thwart more illegal migrants from entering the U.S. At the annual White House Easter egg hunt on Monday, the president reiterated the comments he's made before.
A lot of people are coming in because they want to take advantage of DACA, and we're going to have to really see. They had a great chance. The Democrats blew it. They had a great, great chance, but we'll have to take a look. But Mexico has got to help us at the border. They flow right through Mexico. They send them into the United States. Can't happen that way anymore.
Well, joining us now to talk more about it is immigration attorney Ash Khan Amami at the PATH Law Group in Los Angeles. So the president basically said no deal on DACA, but my understanding is that for now a court has ruled the program has to stay in place.
It is still in place. You know, the courts continue to keep it alive. For those people who are currently here and have received DACA, they can still renew in 2-year increments. For people who have not applied for DACA, they obviously cannot apply for it now. They're not eligible. So for those people, it's a really tough situation. They're sort of in a holding pattern. He sort of dangled the carrot out there that a DACA deal was imminent as recently as a month and a half ago. And now all of a sudden he tweets out that DACA is dead. I think it causes a lot of anxiety for a lot of people. And it's a topic that I think there's broad consensus. We need a resolution. You know, I think on both sides of the aisle, nobody wants to see these young people turned away and taken back to countries that they've never really known.
And also, he's talking a lot about the wall. He wants Mexico to pay for it still. Mexico has obviously, through the past year, made it clear that they have no intention of paying for it. He said that if they don't pay for the wall, he will take a closer look at the North American Free Trade Agreement. How significant is that?
It sounds to me like he's been wanting them to pay for the wall from the beginning, right? I mean, that was one of his campaign promises. And Mexico had a very, very bad reaction to that. They basically told him never to talk about it again in public. And I think that he thought to himself, maybe he could take this opportunity to use NAFTA, because the renegotiations are coming up, to use NAFTA as leverage to get Mexico to pay for the wall. I really don't think that it's going to work. I think that the United States needs NAFTA just as much as Mexico needs NAFTA. I think that a lot of red states rely on these trade agreements for their economic prosperity. And I cannot imagine a scenario where he would be able to pull out of NAFTA without completely alienating whatever of his base is left at this point.
He also made a comment about these caravans of people coming to, are heading for the U.S. border because of their desire to take advantage of DACA. Is that an accurate statement?
Well, the caravans are, it's a group of about 1,000 people coming from, they're currently in Oaxaca, and they're headed to the border. And what they want to do at the border is turn themselves in and request asylum, which, you know, is different than DACA. They want to, if you show up at a U.S. port of entry and you have a valid claim for asylum, then based on U.S. immigration law, you are entitled to a hearing. Trump is, that's who he's referring to when he talks about these caravans. And I think that he's trying to clamp down on granting asylum as well. This really has nothing to do with DACA. I think he's just adding it in there in hopes that the American people will not understand the distinction. He's using it as another way to leverage his border wall agenda.
We are also hearing that senior administration officials told reporters that legislation is being prepared to help expedite some deportations of immigrants in the country illegally.
So this is still sort of opaque. We don't know what exactly the parameters of this are going to be. It seems to me that this is just part of the broader agenda to clamp down on immigration. Administration officials are basically saying that this is more of an administrative thing. There are hundreds of thousands of people in an immigration court backlog, and we're just trying to expedite the process and remove the ones that are clearly guilty of more serious offenses. But who knows? You know, who knows how broad his policy will be on this issue? I mean, I think it's still a developing story. We have no idea.
That's attorney Ashkan Amami at the PATH Law Group in Los Angeles. Thanks for being with us.
You are not going to fight this government with AK-47s because you haven't got any. We have got these hands, our power, the people's power. We are going to dismantle apartheid. We are not prepared for any so-called reforms to apartheid. You cannot reform a sin. Apartheid is a criminal act against mankind.
Winnie Madikizela Mandela, South African anti-apartheid activist and second wife of former South African President Nelson Mandela, died on Monday at the age of 81 after a long illness. President Cyril Ramaphosa made the official announcement to his citizens.
Fellow South Africans, it is with a profound sense of loss and deep sadness that we have learned of the passing away of Winnie Madikizela Mandela. Even at the deepest moments of our struggle for liberation, Mam Winnie was an abiding symbol of the desire of our people to be free. In the midst of repression, she was a voice of defiance and resistance. In the face of exploitation, she was a champion of justice and equality.
Madikizela Mandela was married to Nelson Mandela for 38 years. He was imprisoned for 27 of those years, leaving her to rear their two daughters alone and keep alive their political dream. South Africans are reacting to the death with deep sorrow.
It was a great shock, I must say. As a neighbor, like, you know, we lost a real mother of the nation. So it is something that has been very, very, very painful for us.
I looked up to her as this strong woman that, you know, stood against what men believed as a woman that she couldn't achieve, but yet she stood for what she believed. So, yeah, for me, it's a really sad day.
She was an influential, formidable force during his long imprisonment and was called the Mother of the Nation for her impassioned, high-profile battle to end South Africa's repressive white minority rule. In 1990, the world watched as she walked hand in hand with her then-husband when he walked out of prison. Nelson Mandela became South Africa's first black president in 1994. President Ramaphosa announced that an official national official funeral will be held on April 14th, preceded by a public memorial service on April 11th. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artists. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
Hi, this is Victor Beatty, managing editor of VOA News. Tune in to the Voice of America's newscasts every hour on the top of each hour, 24/7. Listen to our news and correspondent reports from around the world. VOA is your trusted source for news and information.
VOA's International Edition continues now. Well, tensions continue to mount over the fatal police shooting of an unarmed Sacramento, California black man. The family of Stephon Clark joined hundreds of people at a rally over the weekend, urging California's capital city not to let his memory or calls for police reform fade nearly 2 weeks after the 22-year-old was killed by Sacramento officers. He was killed by two officers who were responding to a call of someone breaking into car windows. The day after the shooting, police distributed a news release that said the officers who shot Clark saw the suspect facing them advance toward them with his arms extended and holding an object in his hands. But a private autopsy released by the family showed Clark was shot multiple times in the back. Joining us now to talk about this is retired Los Angeles Police Sergeant Cheryl Dorsey, who is also the author of the book Black and Blue. What exactly does this autopsy say about what possibly happened?
Well, it tells me what I knew initially upon seeing the camcord information that was released from the officer's body cam, and that it should never have happened. This was a property-only crime. And listen, we don't even know if Stephon Clark was guilty of any breaking of car windows, of vandalism. We only know that he was suspected of that. And the fact that he ran does not automatically mean that he was the person responsible for those windows being broken. I don't know how many people I've had run for me in my 20 years of working patrol as an officer and a supervisor. And then when you catch them, you ask, what the heck did you run for? And they say, oh, you know, I didn't have a license, or I got a warrant and I didn't want you to know, and blah, blah, blah. So the fact that they would shoot him for such a minor indiscretion, if you will. Additionally, when we saw they had cover, they were on the side of the grandmother's home when they were engaging him and shouting orders to him. They could have maintained their position on the side of the house, a position of cover and concealment. They had the benefit of an air unit overhead, which was lighting up the area. They could have just freeze-framed, wait till additional units are there to assist them in taking this person into custody. So to shoot 20 times is outrageous, excessive, unnecessary, and then to learn that he was hit 6 times in the back means that he was never a threat, never a threat. And And so someone whose back is to you is certainly not a threat, not 20 bullets a threat. Officers are trained and taught, at least we are here in Los Angeles, fire two rounds in rapid succession and then reassess the threat. I would imagine that the training there in Sacramento is very similar. They certainly don't train you to empty out a magazine, which could be as many as 15 rounds, before you reassess the threat.
So basically, why do you think that these officers reacted the way they did?
Well, you know, I can't get in their head, but I would just say that I believe that they were just caught up in the moment. Because, listen, I've been in foot pursuits, and adrenaline is running. You're amped up. I get that. But then that's when your training should kick in. That's when common sense should kick in. Because at the end of a foot pursuit, generally, bad things happen. And then we see what I call people becoming a victim of contempt of cop. We see officers punishing the individual once they catch them because they had to run and they had to go over a fence and whatever else they had to do in pursuit of this person. And so just simply say, I thought he had a gun or I thought I saw a gun is unacceptable. We're not trained to think, particularly when you're dealing with a deadly force situation. You need to know. You don't get a do-over if you get it wrong.
We are hearing about so many of these cases of young black men being shot by police officers. Do you think things are starting to shift now with people rising up and saying, this has to stop?
Well, the reason that I think it's happening is because there's no consequence. There's no accountability for police officers who shoot black and brown men unnecessarily outside of the policy of their department. There's no personal financial liability when that happens. Taxpayer pick up the burden of a civil suit in case there's one given to the family. So what does the officer learn? What has he been shown that would cause him to do anything differently the next time? Nothing. And so unless and until officers are held accountable for errant behavior, for out-of-policy shootings that result in a death or great bodily harm, then this is going to continue to happen.
We've been seeing quite a movement with these young people rising up against gun violence in general. And we heard several young African-Americans coming out and saying, we are tired of seeing African-Americans targeted.
We have examples. And these are just the things that we hear about. We have examples of black men being shot and killed by police. Now, these are the things that make national news. There's so many other instances that don't end up in a death that we don't hear about. I had a mother reach out to me last. Her young son in Wheeler County, Georgia, savagely beaten by the sheriff deputies there. 16-year-old kid, Cameron Brockington, walking home a block or so away from home. Officers engage him, want to have a conversation with him, ask him for his ID, and he says, I've done nothing wrong, officer, but I live right up the street. And because he didn't produce his ID, they savagely beat this kid. We didn't hear about that. It's not making national news. But this is a thing that goes on. And so for the White House to say that this is a local problem is insulting and it's offensive. It's a national problem, but it's only happening to people who are black and brown. So I would be left to think then that the White House doesn't care because it's not happening to little white kids. It's not a national issue. It's a black issue. And so it's unimportant to the current administration in the White House. And as a mother of four black sons, I find that offensive.
All right. Well, we appreciate your perspective. Retired Los Angeles Police Sergeant Cheryl Dorsey and author of the book Black and Blue. And finally, today we turn to the latest on social media with Doug Bernard. And Doug, I understand you're talking about the president's form of communication, Twitter, which he's been pretty busy with the past few days. What's the latest?
We've also often addressed President Trump's use of social media, particularly Twitter, really seems to be his favorite platform. And I think today what we might just do is take a look at this tweet storm that he went on Monday morning, just to explore how the president uses Twitter to make policy announcements. We know he's hired and fired people and that kind of thing. So let's just take a look at just a few of the policy pronouncements that he made in this tweet storm. A story that's been getting some attention, a owner of a number of local television stations, Sinclair Broadcasting, asked all of their news departments to read this pre-prepared kind of editorial. And while some on the left side of the equation have been, you know, calling it fake news itself, the president turned to that. He said, "So funny to watch the fake news networks, among the most dishonest groups of people I've ever dealt with, criticize Sinclair Broadcasting for being biased. Sinclair is far superior superior to CNN and even more fake NBC, which is a total joke. He then again turns to his feud that he's having with Amazon, possibly in part because Amazon owner and founder Jeff Bezos also owns the Washington Post. The president tweets out, "Only fools or worse are saying that our money-losing post office makes money with Amazon. They lose a fortune. This will be changed. Also, our fully tax-paying retailers are losing stores all over the country." And then, if all of this were not enough, he turns his attention to the Department of Justice. So sad the Department of Justice and the FBI are slow walking or not even giving the unredacted documents requested by Congress, an embarrassment to our country. So six topics there over the course of about seven tweets, over the course of about 3 hours that he spent doing this. And it's just interesting to see how the president is really taken to Twitter as, I think, his kind of primary means of communication, it seems, and then just kind of leaves everybody else to debate amongst themselves what it is and pick up the pieces.
All right, that was Doug Bernard with our social media segment. You can follow him on Twitter at DFrontiers. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. And you have been listening to International Edition. That does it for today, but find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Dave Magnus. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In an effort to limit resources that fuel the civil war in South Sudan, the United States Department of Commerce has imposed licensing requirements on 15 of the country's oil-linked entities whose revenues have contributed to the ongoing crisis in South Sudan. This means that all exports, re-exports, and transfers to these entities of any items originating in the United States will now require an export license. According to the World Bank, with oil revenue accounting for almost all of its exports and around 60% of its gross domestic product, South Sudan is the world's most oil-dependent country. Through this action, the United States hopes to increase pressure to end the country's five-year-old civil war and the resulting humanitarian crisis. In December 2013, less than 18 months after it declared its independence from Sudan, a power struggle between President Salva Kiir and Vice President Riek Machar spiraled into civil war. The continued fighting has cost the lives of tens of thousands of people and led to a devastated economy, human rights abuses, hunger, and malnutrition. One-third of the population has been displaced by the violence, nearly 2 million internally and more than 2 million who have fled to neighboring countries. The 15 entities include South Sudan's Ministries of Mining and Petroleum and state oil firm Nile Petroleum. Also included are Dar Petroleum Operating Company, oil distributor Nayakek & Sons, Greater Pioneer Operating Company, Juba Petrotech Technical Services, and Sud Petroleum Operating Company. The listed entities are a source of substantial revenue for the government of South Sudan, said State Department spokesperson Heather Nauert. Unfortunately, the South Sudanese government and corrupt official actors use this revenue to purchase weapons and fund irregular militias that undermine the peace, security, and stability of South Sudan, rather than support the welfare and current emergency food needs of the South Sudanese people. "The government of South Sudan can do better," said Heather Nauert. "As the largest donor of aid to South Sudan, the United States is proud to uphold humanitarian values and deliver vital assistance. The government of South Sudan must not squander that generosity and should take concrete steps to provide for the vast needs of the South Sudanese people."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.